Hello, my name is Peter Zablocki, and I'm a historian, author, and college professor. I'm thrilled to invite you to check out Evergreen Network's History Shorts podcast. Every Tuesday and Thursday, join me on a journey through time, exploring the little-known and hidden gems of history. In each bite-sized episode, I'll dive into my original research to bring you intriguing historical curiosities you've probably never heard of, uncovering the fascinating stories that have shaped our world, from forgotten figures to overlooked events. Subscribe now and never miss an episode of the History Shorts podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts. This is Peter.
And this is Tom.
And you're listening to History Teachers Talking Podcast,
part of the Evergreen Podcast Network.
All right, this is Peter Zablocki and Thomas Reska, and welcome back to our podcast. Tommy, what do we got today?
Well, today we're going to look at a topic that I guess definitely doesn't get talked about as much in history classes. If it does, it only gets talked about during the Vietnam era.
Which would
really be about this time of year, right around now, is when teachers are kind of touching on Vietnam, maybe give or take a little bit. But yeah, so what we're going to be looking at is a history of POWs.
American
POWs. So POWs are prisoners of war. So individuals who, from no fault of their own, you know, they're basically everyday people who we get put in these situations, get drafted, go off to war and get captured, live out the war, if they do live out the war, in pretty dire situations.
Yeah. And this goes back a long time, obviously. You mentioned this idea of Vietnam. It got me thinking real quick, like before we really get into it. You said a lot of teachers right now, we're recording this, it is May. So a lot of teachers are kind of hopping on this whole let's get to Vietnam thing. And interestingly enough, I feel like there's so much more history being added that ultimately I think high schools are going to have to create like a U.S. History 3 class.
Because it's always been something that's discussed.
Right? Well, because think about it. Where do you stop? I mean, most of the people stop at Vietnam.
Well, it's supposed to be nowadays, I can just say, in the state that we're in, you're supposed to stop with globalization.
Yes.
And you can get to that sort of thing. But I know also in the state where we are, we're in New Jersey. Everyone knows that. But in New Jersey, next year, well, they're looking at some new standards now, actually, in part of a conference that's going to be starting next week. Actually, it begins where they're going to be looking at the standards and any sort of changes they're going to make and probably add new things to the standards. So, yeah, it's going to be growing without a doubt.
Right. It has to be, because you can't finish U.S. history or even, you know, any form of history with Vietnam. I mean, there's so much more to cover. And usually what happens is you get to Vietnam and then you rush through it. You know, even like in college, when I teach survey courses now, it's same thing. It's like boom, 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 boom. If you think about it and look at my syllabus, I have one class to teach like Vietnam. You know, you're like, you can't do justice to that.
Yeah, it's a Vietnam modern era. That's pretty much how it goes.
Yeah,
but you got to remember, when we were in school in like the 80s and 90s, that's when it made sense. It was only 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
But that's not how it is
today's
anymore.
Reality. Yeah, no.
Yeah, so I would think there would probably be some new
changes.
Content being added, even, I don't know, US 3, a third year, a fourth year of required history, which I know is something, with one of them being civics, which are new civic standards put in. But I don't want to get off the topic. But yeah, there's definitely going to be a lot of changes. And also how history is being taught is also, I think,
changing.
Something that's going to change a little bit too.
Right. Let's get back to prisoners of war. So prisoners of war, I think we're going to refer to them simply as POWs going forward. The idea of POWs is intertwined with the history of warfare itself. It's undeniable.
It's always happened.
Exactly. Captivity and a treatment of captives has been enduring features of any armed conflict throughout human history. It stems really from ancient times, medieval period, but I'm just going to kind of briefly go over that and bring us to America's first war, really, as a nation, which would be the American Revolutionary War. But you have POWs, and the taking of prisoners dates back to antiquity. So records of captivity are found in ancient civilizations as early as the earliest ones, really Mesopotamia, Egypt, Greece, and Rome. And those early societies, any captured enemy soldier were often three options: enslaved, killed, or held for ransom. We talked about this when we did our Julius Caesar episode, because he was captured and held for ransom. And he was like, yeah, you guys are not asking enough money for me. And then, by the way, when they pay for me, I will find you one day and kill you. And he winds up doing that. So in the Middle Ages, the treatment of prisoners is kind of varied, really, and depended on a lot of different factors and religious beliefs or even conduct of war. But while some captives were held for ransom or exchange, most were actually now held for forced labor or executed, right? And then you get into like the early modern era, which kind of brings us to where we really are. Practice of taking prisoners of war became really formalized during probably like 1600s. Mm-hmm. And there was actually emergence of laws of war and a development of rules of how to treat captives. And so 1600s is where you actually start having some rules of how do you go about taking in prisoners. And at 100 years kind of brings us to the history of American POWs. And the first time that you could have American POWs would be during the American Revolutionary War. And this is kind of an interesting thing because the British are coming to our new country. So a lot of times they didn't really, as you'll get into, I'm sure, they didn't bring our POWs to England. So what did they do?
It'd be too complicated. It'd be too long. It wasn't going to happen.
Exactly.
It's too expensive, right? So they said about during the Revolutionary War, it was about 20,000 Americans were held captive during the war. About 8,500 of those actually died in captivity. A lot of them were released afterwards with the exchange between America and Great Britain. Most of them were kept basically in these damp, musty prisons, basically on vessels. And they were in Walabout Bay, New York, in Charleston Harbor, South Carolina, and also St. Lucia in the West Indies, which we'll get to, that becomes something big in a minute. If you died, they just tossed you overboard, or you were taken ashore and buried in a shallow grave. Like I said, a lot of them were returned afterward. There's information on this if you want to do a deeper dive, but you're not going to find too much because it was kind of just they got captured and then put into one of these camps, and that's where they were kept. But a lot of the soldiers that weren't released or exchanged after the war for British POWs were basically sold into the Barbary pirates of North Africa. And they were used, and then they were used as slavery labor until they were ransomed back. By the U.S. government, I believe, did buy a lot of their freedoms back later on. And also by their families, if they came from families that had enough money, they would get them out. That was just kind of like what you would do back then too. You would capture someone, pirates would capture you and then ransom you back. It was a way to make money.
Yeah. And the closest POW camp, traditional POW camp that the British could really muster was actually in Fort Niagara. So Niagara Falls, New York, which was on the border of Canada. So Canada was still loyal to the British, obviously, at this time. So there were actually Continental Army prisoners that were brought to Canada. But for the most part, as you said, they were put on these
ships,
floating basically prisons. And these weren't even nice ships. These prison ships were...
Well, they're also ships from the 1700s, so how nice...
True.
Keep that in mind, too. So yeah, there's no like air conditioning or even...
air conditioning.
Or even good ventilation. You know what I mean?
Yes.
They're just there and chained up the whole time. Yeah, it was...
Right? They were not new ships either. So these were captured, obsolete ships that the British did not want to use. So damage, ships that were seeping water in.
Oh, yeah.
Rats and they were everywhere. Yeah, literally rats everywhere. People just went to the bathroom where they could, and they just kept them off the shore on these ships. And often a lot of these prisoners wanted to just jump off and die anyway. As you mentioned, the idea was that if you live nearby, specifically near Brooklyn, New York, off the shores of Brooklyn, New York, which is where you had one of the most infamous boats, HMS Jersey, you had so many people that died, were just thrown overboard, as you mentioned, that if you lived in nearby area, you would literally be fishing out bodies daily.
Yeah.
People would just wake up and be like, all right, there's another couple of bodies. Right. So now it took just regular American colonists would have to bury these bodies that they would find near their shores because they didn't want to be walking by dead bodies all the time. And oftentimes it was like, well, we don't know who these people are, so just bury them here kind of thing. Quite a lot of people, like you mentioned, I was not aware of it before doing this research, that about 20,000 Americans were held prisoners. I thought that was
something that, again, it's not talked about, at least not in the history books. You know, when they cover the revolution, it's a little bit different. It's more of the battles, you know, Lexington, Concord, things of that, Yorktown, and the work went on in the South and things of that nature, what the Americans were fighting for. They're not talking about like the POWs. That's not really associated with it. But again, like you said before, Pete, it's all part of warfare. So it's a continuation. You're not going to find a conflict that goes on that doesn't have POWs. It's just,
absolutely,
that doesn't happen.
Well, and even a smaller conflict. So War of 1812, which takes place shortly after Revolutionary War. And by shortly, you know, it's not that shortly, but, you know, within 20 years or so. Well, 30, I guess. It's not a big conflict. And England doesn't really get super involved until the latter stages of the War of 1812. So there is not a lot, but there are some POWs. And people are actually, Americans are starting to be taken to England to be held in prisons. But even more important than being held in prisons.
It's a very... infamous British prison.
Yep. But then they said that oftentimes this is also when England has a problem with having enough people in their navy, which is what starts this war in the first place.
Yeah.
So a lot of times you had American prisoners were simply impressed into the British Navy. So, you know, you were kidnapped or imprisoned during this war, And as opposed to being thrown into a particular prison, you were told, all right, you could go and rot in this prison in England, or you could get on this, British vessel and do what you got to do. And that's what oftentimes they had to do. The one interesting story is that we might not even have.
Yes, I was just going to get to that.
Yeah, go.
Oh, you can go. Well, it's basically our national anthem, the Star Spangled Banner, was written by Francis Scott Key while he was aboard one of these British vessels in Baltimore Harbor.
He was the lawyer for a prisoner. And then when he got on the boat, they said, no, you got to stay.
You're here too. So he wasn't there, I don't think, for very long either.
No, he was there for a day or two, yeah.
But still, he was there, and he was technically a prisoner of war, and it's the only national anthem that would make sense, right? National anthem that's written by a prisoner of war. Now, it wasn't a song originally, it was a poem. Yeah. But still, that was kind of an interesting story. Well, how it tied in. About over about 10,000 or so prisoners of war, from the War of 1812 that were American. So you have that. And obviously, our next big conflict.
Well, this one's a biggie.
See a lot. Obviously, whenever you talk about American history, we talk about the Civil War. It's always, the one with the most casualties, the one with the most injuries because it was American versus American. But you actually had about 194,000 and 214,000 Union and Confederate soldiers became prisoners of war during that conflict. And most of the Union soldiers died in Confederate prison camps.
Did you see pictures of, there's
horrible, images. Yeah.
When you start looking at Union Army soldiers that were held in Confederate prisoner of war camps, particularly Andersonville, those images exist because cameras were already out, or early cameras were out during the Civil War. You think you're looking at the Holocaust survivor pictures, right?
It's crazy. And there was some reasons why, because both sides really expected a very short war. So they really didn't prepare for a large number of POWs during the 4 years that the war lasted. So as they were taken, at least in the beginning, a lot of exchanges were kind of worked out just by the commanders. Are you captured this many? We'll capture this many.
But did you see what happened? Yeah, did you see what happened though?
Yeah, well, as time went on, they kind of get more disagreements arose. And then the number of prisoners of war increased, and in prison facilities on both sides, which again small, so it became overcrowded. You had mismanagement. The really thing became lack of planning and lack of clean water and stuff like that.
Food.
They couldn't food. They didn't have, well, particularly in the South, they didn't have enough food.
They didn't have food to feed their own army. So they're like, POWs, just let them die.
Feed the POW. That's what really happened in Andersonville. But then you also have, when the North started hearing about that, they were like, well, it was like retaliation, and they're going to inflict some of the same punishments on Confederate soldiers. So it led to a lot of suffering on both sides.
There was, brother versus brother, right? So initially this was, as you mentioned, okay, listen, we're going to just swap each other's prisoners. So five of mine for five for yours. Until 1863, that was pretty much the case. And in 1863, the issue came about because of African-American prisoners of war. So African-Americans were being conscripted or volunteered into African-American units in the Union forces. And then what winds up happening is while they are captured, the assumption here is it's like you should trade them back and forth for the same thing. So we want an African-American soldier back, we'll give you one Confederate soldier back. Yeah. And what these guys started arguing about is essentially the Confederacy refused to treat black and white Union prisoners equally. And that's kind of what broke it down. And there's this famous saying, I don't remember the exact words, by Ulysses S. Grant when he was approached and he was told look, this whole prison exchange is falling apart. What do we do? And he said, well, we could afford for them to keep our prisoners and replenish our armies, but the Confederacy cannot. And that was kind of the thing. All right, we'll hold their prisoners because they're poor, they don't have money, nor do they have enough people to continue to grow their armies. And that's kind of where we went with. Some of these things were, there's so many different camps, but Andersonville by far is the worst one.
That's the one you probably hear the most about in history. If this ever does reach the history books, which I know it does, the POWs and the Civil War does get talked about, basically just with Andersonville. That's it. And even then, I think that's more of a upper level class that's going to discuss that.
So it was actually known as Camp Sumter, the Andersonville, Georgia. Yeah, but 45,000 Union soldiers were confined there. Again, if you guys look at the images of this, it does get pretty intense. It was established in 1864 because there were so many growing, the number of Union prisoners was growing.
They didn't know what to do with them. It's the same thing.
Let's design this thing to hold 10,000 prisoners. That's really what it was. It was surrounded by a stockade wall, wooden logs, and the prisoners were housed in these makeshift shelters that were basically made out of scraps of wood, cloth even, whatever materials they could find or scavenge. But instead of holding 10,000, it held 40,000. So 45,000, that's more than four times what it was designed for. And even when it was designed for that, it was, again, it was, it looked like a Hooverville.
It could not handle it. It was just beyond its scope, beyond anything. You could just imagine the filth that was there, the disease that ran rampant. So that's why you have so many deaths. If they're not eating, they're not, you know, they don't have energy, they don't have the nutrition, so they're more susceptible to disease. Plus the human waste and everything, the bad conditions, the smoldering heat too. This was in Georgia.
Yeah.
So.
Well, if think of it this way, there was also supposedly this really infamous commander of the camp, Captain Henry Wirtz, I think, W-I-R-Z, Wirtz. It was a Swiss-born Confederate officer, and he was tasked with overseeing the camp. And he was so bad about and just kind of nonchalant about the death towards American Union soldiers that he was later tried by the military tribunal and became the only person executed for war crimes committed during the Civil War.
Yeah, it was only open for 14 months.
Isn't that nuts?
True, and it was that much death and just yeah.
So anyway, after the war, the camp was closed. Efforts were made to
provide. Yes, they weren't going to keep it open, Pete.
Well, the other thing is the efforts were made to provide like proper burial for thousands of the soldiers that perished there. But even then, like they didn't, a lot of them were not identified. So it was kind of hard.
Yeah.
Today, it's a National Historic Site. It's still there. But there was something else I wanted to say about this, and I totally forgot. Okay, I forgot. So let's move on to the next conflict.
The Spanish-American War, which is a total 180 basically from the Civil War when it comes to POWs. Because the Spanish-American War only lasted for 3 months, and there was actually less than a dozen American prisoners of war. So there wasn't really many. And those POWs were quickly exchanged by the United States because the United States captured over 150,000 Mexican soldiers, the Spanish soldiers during this time. So it was pretty much like a one-sided conflict. Most of the prisoners that were taken were...
They exchanged, weren't they exchanged?
Yeah. Well, yeah, all the American soldiers were exchanged for, yeah. So none died in any prisons at that time.
All right, so that brings us to our next one, which is World War One.
World War One, yeah.
World War One doesn't have as many as I thought, to be honest.
No, well, yeah, remember, the United States was only in it from 1917 to 1918.
Yeah.
So it's about not even 5,000, about what they roughly 4,120 Americans were held prisoners of the war.
Yeah.
And 147 of them died in captivity. But there were, what makes this unique is there were rules for the treatment of POWs were put in place years before the war. So they basically still were supposed to be given adequate food, adequate water. It still didn't always happen.
Well, because of...
They were supposed to be treated better.
Yes.
There were rules put in place a little bit now. I think one reason why it was so much lower was just because the nature of that war, like you weren't really taking prisoners.
Yeah, no, they were dying in trenches.
You were dying in trenches. It was much different, yeah.
The Geneva Conventions represent like this pivotal because there was a few, but before World War One is only really one, the first Geneva Convention of 1864. That's like a pivotal moment in development of a form of international like humanitarian law that was specifically designed.
When we go to war and kill each other.
Humanely, yes, if that makes sense, right?
Like, they even talked about like what type of knives they could use and stuff like that, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like there's so many different things.
This was designed particularly for prisoners of war. But the first Geneva Convention adopted in 1864, first ever international treaty to establish rules for the humane treatment of sick and wounded soldiers on the battlefield. It was started because of a humanitarian activist, Henry Dunant, I think. Dunant. D-U-N-A-N-T. He winds up... He wants to basically like mitigate any form of suffering of soldiers. That's his big thing, right? And he wants to... He just wants like impartial treatment of wounded combatants and establishment of some volunteer aid societies. Eventually, it gets revised by the second Geneva Convention, 1906, and added protections for wounded, sick, shipwrecked members of armed forces at sea. The idea is like this is how you treat if you have a wounded soldier. You need to bring him to the hospital. You need to save them. Like, let's be human about it. And this eventually, there's another Geneva Convention, a third one in 1929. That introduces further protections. And these are actually specific for interrogation, which is interesting, how people can be interrogated. That's what often you see in movies, like serial rank number, that's all I'm giving you, because according to the Geneva Convention, that's all I have to give you. And that was the 1929 Geneva Convention. Until the 1949 one, it's considered a major milestone in the development of international humanitarian laws, the 1949 post-World War II, because it includes all of these other ones, but then establishes like additional protocols, comprehensive protections for victims of the armed conflict, prisoners of war. And that stems from World War II. So I don't know if you have anything to add to World War One, but I know that most of World War One people that were captured were pilots. And I think it's the same for World War Two.
Yeah, American wise, they were pilots.
There
were some interesting ones too. I remember that movie. I can't remember the name of the movie right now, but it was about the Americans in the Argonne Forest.
The Lost Battalion.
Lost Battalion, and a couple of them get captured, and they're actually treated very humanely by the Germans at that point. It was different. Warfare was still kind of seen, I would say, by like a game of chess at that point. There were rules and stuff like that. You had to do certain things. You were supposed to surrender when captured. So they were treated a little bit different, at least at that point in the war. But World War II becomes much different.
The Battle of Waterloo was one of the most famous turning points in world history. But what happened next? My name's David Montgomery, and I'm the host of The Siecle, a history podcast that tackles exactly that. Join me as I cover France's overlooked century in between Napoleon and World War I. The Siecle, spelled S-I-E-C-L-E, is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network and can be found wherever you get podcasts.
Yeah, and again, most of them that got, most Americans that were held, at least in Europe, which there was about 94,000 of them, were shot down flying missions over Germany, or they were captured at the Battle of the Bulge. And at first, the conditions were actually pretty good if you were captured by the Germans. But as
I keep thinking of what's that show, Hogan's Heroes.
Yeah, Hogan's Heroes. So yeah, it was something like, well, not common.
I wouldn't
like
say that. Yeah, but
you know, they were humanely treated for the most part. But
in comparison to what the Japanese did to America,
to what the Japanese did, which we'll get to. But like as the war drew to a close, the same things you started seeing: malnutrition, overcrowding, lack of medical attention. Again, when a country is on the brink of defeat, they don't have the supplies to keep their own army fed and clothed. They're not going to do it to the opposing army. You know, they're not going to have them out. So as American and Russian forces started closing in opposite directions, a lot of these American POWs were taken from camps, and they were forced to march to avoid the Allied forces before they eventually get overrun, and then they're repatriated. You know, they're freed, basically. The Pacific was much different. You had about 30,000 Americans were imprisoned by the Japanese. Most of these happened during the fall of the Philippines.
Oh, yeah.
And like the Bataan Death March. And they suffered a over 40% death rate, which is, you know, a huge amount, obviously. And they suffered brutal captivity. They were crowded into hell ships. And these hell ships were basically sent back to Japan, where a lot of them were actually torpedoed and sunk. But for the ones who survived the all the way back to Japan, they were basically just forced to work in mines and things like that. 7 days a week, minimal food, just beaten. And a lot of them were actually taken and killed as Japan was losing the war. They were taken, just shot. They wanted to just get like,
well, if not shot, they were literally beheaded.
Yeah, beheaded. Well, that would happen at the Death March too. Again, as they're just walking and falling, they were just attacked, brutalized, run over, right? And just continually, you know, they would just run them over with tanks and stuff like that. They died. The Japanese were brutal. We talked about that with some of our other podcasts, like 31 and stuff like that. They were going to be just as brutal to prisoners of war.
I mean, the death rates among American POWs in the Pacific were staggering. I think nearly 40% of American POWs held by the Japanese had died in captivity, making it one of the highest mortality rates in American military history. The combination of harsh treatment, forced labor, lack of adequate food, medical care, I don't want to say designed, but on purpose, really, violence. And even in the last moments of the war, you were talking the last 48 hours of the war, after the bomb, second bomb was dropped on Nagasaki, they were like, you know what? First of all, a lot of times they were killed because the Japanese were afraid that there would be evidence of what had been done to them.
They wanted to kind of erase it from history, which
exactly.
Wasn't,
so
wasn't
like,
going to happen, but
They would behead them. They would bury them. The idea was like, do not... In any way, like they almost didn't want evidence of what bad shape these American POWs were in. And if you read James Bradley's book, Flyboys, I mean, it got to such an extent that in certain circumstances, American POWs were not just mistreated and beheaded. They were actually eaten. I mean, literally, there were proven cases where some American flyers were, they were beheaded or castrated or whatever else the terrible way to go was. And then usually it was a piece of their leg that was taken off and like their liver. And it was eaten by some of the camp people that owned the camps. Again, by far, some of the worst treatment ever of POWs happened during the Pacific War. And the psychological abuse, right? Torture at the hands of the captors, interrogations, beatings, being tied up and left in a sun in the Pacific, right, where you literally your skin would burn. These are considered common mistreatments by the Japanese that were seeking to coerce compliance, I guess, from prisoners. Chronic health problems from those that actually survived this thing. The one thing, too, that I saw kept on popping up is POWs in World War II, part of like their mission, I guess, was as a POW, it was your duty to try to escape.
And supposedly, that's what Hogan's Heroes was basically based on. Yeah, it was. Yep. It kind of goes with the lore of like World War II, also like the bridge on the River Kwai and things like that. Like, yep, whatever you can do to still, yeah, you're captured, but you're still contributing to the war effort. And by trying to escape, you're doing that. You're taking manpower, you're taking the attention away and focusing out. When in actuality, like if you got caught trying to do it, they would just kill you.
Well, yeah.
Like that, there was no if, ands, or buts about that. You're trying to escape. All right, we're going to beat you. Maybe won't kill you the first time just because we want to show an example to people. But then eventually they're going to kill you because it's just that's what they're going to do.
I mean, remember the movie The Great Escape?
Yeah.
Which is actually based on a real thing. So The Great Escape took place at Stalag Luft 3. It was a German prison of war camp that's actually now in Poland, at the time was Germany, held primarily Allied airmen, but also British, Canadian, American, and other ones. And the escape was very meticulously planned. It took them months to try to get out. You know, they literally used spoons, tins, wooden boards, anything to get these tunnels dug up. And on March 24th, 1944, the escape attempt commenced. They actually managed to tunnel beneath the perimeter of defense, and they made their way to freedom. A total of 76 prisoners escaped through the tunnels that night. Now, despite a successful initial escape, though, most of them were unfortunately... I guess the movie that alludes to that, a lot of them do die, but they were recaptured by the authorities in a matter of days. So they didn't really get that far.
Yeah,
I mean, you're in Germany, basically, right? So the retribution, 50 of the 76 prisoners that were recaptured were executed to deter further escapes. And that's kind of also what the Japanese would do as well. If an American POW would escape, they would usually kill a few POWs that remain.
So you knew that, too. If you tried to escape, you got away, they were going to kill some of your friends. And it's like,
It was a way
of keeping people from doing that.
Exactly. And before we move on, the one thing I would recommend, there's a book by a POW called, his name was Daniel Culler, C-U-L-L-E-R. If you guys get a chance, it's a short, quick read. It's a memoir. The book is called Prisoner of the Swiss. And let me tell you, that book was intense. So people thought that they were a neutral country, which was a common misconception in a sense. Yeah, they were neutral, but they didn't want to rock the boat or, you know, really anger the Germans too much. Dan Culler was an American airman that was shot down, had to land in Switzerland. And, you know, everyone thought like, oh, at least you made it to Switzerland. But he was put in a POW camp, even though he was an American. His story, guys, is, I mean, he was raped multiple times. He was beaten to barely living. Insane. And the federal government, after the war ends, actually denies that he did this. And it takes until like 2000s for the government to be like, yeah, that happened. The Swiss had some POW camps where Americans were held and terrible things happened to them. But when he got back, they were like, yeah, you weren't really a POW. You were just hanging out in Switzerland. And he was like, no, like this is what happened to me. Amazing book, guys. If you get a chance to read it again. Kind of crazy. But I think that kind of brings us to our next two wars, which now we're moving post-World War II, Korean War and the Vietnam War. I did not know much about POWs in the Korean War until I started doing this particular research. And first of all, over 7,000 Americans were captured.
Yeah. But the big thing was that during the Korean War, they did not abide by the Geneva Convention.
Exactly.
So that's why you had a good number were killed during that. 2,700 died while imprisoned. So...
Did you see that in that one big thing that was happening was the fact that they went into...
They tried the re-education.
Exactly. So, it was like this central strategy by North Korean Chinese captors was to convert American and as well as South Korean prisoners of war into a communist ideology. Like the idea was to undermine the Americans' allegiance to their own countries. So while they had these POWs, they didn't just lock them up. They were like, we're going to re-educate you. And like in this indoctrination of communism.
Yeah,
so,
basically, make you become a communist, make you switch sides.
And the idea was that eventually you would be released, you would go back to the United States, and you would spread this communist propaganda. But prisoners were subjected to rigorous and prolonged political indoctrination sessions, hours each day, right? There was like designated areas in POW camps. You're required to attend lectures, participate in study groups, write papers, engage in discussion about communist ideology. You had to recite communist slogans, beliefs, learn how to sing communist, pro-communist songs. There was threats, intimidation, manipulation. And they'd be like, we know your family in America. We know where they live.
They would do anything. Yeah, they were doing. They're basically trying to get them to switch sides or just denounce in any way. And the same thing happens in Vietnam. Well, there was something similar that happens in Vietnam. And you see that a lot of the movies that portray that. But it was a way of brainwashing, a way of also, it was propaganda. I think that's when you start seeing this more in Korea. Start seeing it from the beginning of Korea. You see it more in later wars. Is the idea that prisoners of war can be used as propaganda.
Yeah.
If you get into the switch sides, that can be very valuable in the public opinion, particularly if you're fighting a war against America, because no one wants to see their soldiers captured, just wants to see them paraded on 1950s, you have TV and stuff like that. You can start, you know, doing those sorts of things.
The Manchurian Candidate, it was a novel that came out in 1959, and later it became a film in 1962, which I think was remade in 2004. But the story was literally playing off a real event. Now, it wasn't a real event. I shouldn't say that. Off of real fears, I guess. Because if you guys have ever read or seen the movie Manchurian Candidate, it was this idea that of indoctrination, that someone was brainwashed in Korea and hypnotized to eventually come back to the United States and be activated to like kill the president or somebody else or some important person. But this was influenced by fears and rumors that were coming out of the Korean War about the treatment of American POWs. This idea of intense indoctrination and psychological manipulation. And people are like, are the POWs coming back from Korea? Like, are they okay? Like, can we trust them? Like, there was generally that fear because of the information that was coming out. Even you mentioned this at the beginning, when you talk about POWs, American POWs, probably the most infamous POW experience, although by numbers, you know, nothing in comparison to the Civil War, which has hundreds of thousands of POWs, yes. was Vietnam.
Right? It's probably the one that's most associated with that because it was one of America's longest wars. Yeah.
So what do we got about Vietnam?
I don't want to downplay it, like you said before, but there were 766 Americans are known to be prisoners of war during this time. There were more than that, but those are the known ones, because that's not counting MIAs, right? Missing in actions, which were more than over 200 of those. So about 144 died during captivity. But unlike previous wars, the length of the POWs is much more. A lot of them were, you know, in prison for 7 years or more. And torture was very common, mostly because the Geneva Convention wasn't followed, but it was also because the North Vietnamese claimed that the Americans weren't soldiers, so they didn't have to be protected under the Geneva Convention. They were political
criminals.
So because of that, they were able to be tortured. And the torture was severe. Like, it was, besides just beatings and things like that, they would beat them with pieces of iron, prolonged solitary confinement. The whole idea was just to make things worse. Malnutrition, leaving them in extreme temperatures and stuff like that, burning them. It was anything they could basically do to try to reach a breaking point and then get them to somehow cooperate in some form or another. I think one of the most famous ones was when in 1966, Commander Jeremiah Denton, right? He was a captured Navy pilot. And he was forced to appear on television. He was like saying certain things. But,
blinking, right?
But famously, I think he blinked in Morse code the word torture. So, and that basically confirmed to U.S. intelligence that the prisoners were being, how they were being treated. They're like, all right, we got to do something to get them out, because they actually, American soldiers, they actually had raids on some of these camps, and they actually were successful at first. And then that's when the North Vietnamese started moving these camps deeper into the territory, like Hanoi. Yeah. So they keep them out and did brutal treatment. But, you know, John McCain, right? Former.
Senator, I mean, he was
tortured.
Was probably the most famous or infamous of the cases, right?
Well, just because he still has scars on him today, like up until his death. And how he walked and stuff like that,
And you mentioned a few things here that I want to kind of unpack. One of the things was the resilience of the American POWs, because they developed this elaborate system of communication and solidarity when they were in camps. They would tap out messages in code, communicating through subtle gestures and signals, like you said, like blinking or just tapping out messages that would still communicate. And they actually organized acts of resistance and defiance. They refused to provide any information to their captors, no matter what. They adhered to these, like, to the strict code of conduct. It's known as the code of conduct for members of the armed forces of the U.S. And a lot of them did attempt escapes. You know, that happened often. Some escapes involved meticulously planned, elaborate schemes, kind of depicted in movies. They would dig tunnels. That was a big one, too. And not a lot of were successful. But probably the most famous, infamous Vietnam War POW is Senator John McCain, right? So born into a military family, that's what that was key. His father and grandfather were both four-star admirals in the U.S. Navy, so he followed in their footsteps and joined the Naval Academy during, I think it was 1967, his 23rd bombing mission over North Vietnam. His aircraft shot down by surface-to-air missile. He's ejected from his plane, parachutes into a lake. He is captured and taken to the infamous Hanoi Hilton, is what the POWs called it. He was subjected to brutal interrogation and torture. They would break his arms, and then as soon as they healed, they would re-break his arms. They knew who he was, so they're like, dude, we'll exchange you back. Like, you could go back to the U.S., and we could exchange you for some really, you know, a big number of our POWs because of who his father was. And he refused. He was like, no, I'm staying. I'm an American soldier, and I need to stay. I'm a naval aviator. And the only information he gave was his name, rank, and serial number, and date of birth. So super strict adherence to the military code of conduct for POWs. And he winds up staying there. I mean, he was there for 5.5 years.
Yeah, so that's a long. Think about that, yeah.
Right? And 5.5 years. And the only information he gave was, here's my name, here's my rank, here's my serial number. He emerged as a leader among all the other POWs in the camp. Like, everyone's like, dude, this guy's like refusing to break. Finally released in 73 as part of Operation Homecoming. It was a big prisoner exchange between the United States and North Vietnam. He winds up coming back a hero, but like you said, physical injuries and psychological scars from his time as a POW, I mean, they continue to affect him for the rest of his life, which was also such a slap in the face when a former president said that he was not a real hero because real heroes don't get captured.
Don't get captured. Well, that's a whole other issue right there, a whole other story right there. But I thought was also interesting about Vietnam, the war, is that years later, so a lot of them get released, supposed Operation Homecoming. But there's, in Vietnam itself, there is a lot of talk, and even in 2000, the year 2000, they were talking about that there's these officials that come out and say, listen, I was there. There was no torture going on during the Vietnam War. These are Vietnamese, like, you know, government officials now that were in the North Vietnamese army back then. And they said, you know, there may have been a few times they slapped someone or something like that, or some threats, but there was never any widespread torture. That's just been fabricated by the West. And we want to move past that now so we can have better relations with the United States. So it was kind of interesting that, like, it's very similar. You see the same thing in Japan. Japan is not so much of like ignoring it. It's more of like, not so much denying it, but more of ignoring it. Like, oh, that was the past. Let's just let the past be in the past type of thing. But in Vietnam, it's more just like a complete denial of what happened.
Interesting.
Not everywhere, but there's a lot of government officials that will just deny it.
Yeah. All right. So really, I mean, there's only one other war that there actually were POWs captured, and that was initial Persian Gulf War, correct?
The first one, 1991. Yeah, and I do remember this one a little bit because we were a little bit older, and I remember seeing some of the prisoners that did get captured. They were paraded on TV, and this made actually, it was 23 Americans that were captured, but were made this also unique with two women were actually captured.
Yeah.
And they were also tortured, basically physical abuse, mostly beating with pipes. Their eardrums were busted. They were given electrical shocks from car batteries and stuff like that. And the Iraqi government basically said, we're going to use these prisoners, we're threatened to use them as human shields, which is, again, all violation of the Geneva Convention.
Yeah.
But all 23 were eventually returned home to the United States by the time the war ended.
And, you know, you bring up a good point to kind of, you know, put all this together to close.
Well, that's what I do, Peter. I bring up good points.
Right. To kind of end the podcast, because despite all these international agreements and conventions, the treatment of prisoners of war is still a contentious issue, right? I mean, allegations of torture, abuse, unlawful detention, these things surface all the time in recent conflicts even. And they raise a lot of questions about compliance with the international law and the enforcement of the Geneva Convention standards, because you simply say, like, what the Vietnamese would say, well, they're not really POWs, or they're terrorists, it's different, or, you know what I mean? Like, it is still such a contentious thing to this very day, POWs. And throughout history, really, the treatment of prisoners of war reflected a broader ethical, legal, and humanitarian consideration, right, that surrounds warfare, this big moral question about warfare. I feel like as long as Earth exists, there's going to be wars and there's going to be warfare. You know, with sayings such as all is fair in love and war, you know, I think we have a long way to go. I think we're improved since ancient times.
You're never going to be responsible for these war crimes if you win. So,
yeah, I mean, the reality of war, no matter how you spin it, is going to continue to expose the vulnerability of prisoners, right, to abuse, exploitation, neglect. I mean, it's it's inevitable that that's what's going to happen. Anyway, I guess it's like a sadder podcast, but at the end of the day, you know, the people that, the men and women of this country that have been prisoners of war, I mean, these guys, nearly the ultimate sacrifice, right? These people know courage, freedom.
Well, they know grit, basically. Yeah.
Nuts.
It's a situation that, you know, very few people
could survive.
Could survive, understand, comprehend even. Yeah.
Yeah. Nuts. All right. Well, I think that pretty much sums up this episode. So thank you so much, guys. If you need to find us, you can find us at www.historyteacherstalkingpodcast.com. Do not forget to leave a review. Tell your friends about us. Make sure you tune in every 2 weeks to see what we got going for you guys. And we do appreciate your emails. Please keep them coming. Thanks so much. And we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Stay safe, everybody.
I hope everyone enjoyed our podcast, and if you would like to email us, you can do so at historyteacherspodcast@gmail.com.
Welcome to Anthology of Heroes, the podcast that explores the most pivotal moments of history through the eyes of those who lived it. In this podcast, we don't spend our time recounting facts and dates. Instead, we follow in the footsteps of national heroes, kings, or ordinary people who lived and breathed the moments that shaped our world. We're not hemmed in by eras, borders, or religions. Instead, we seek out the tales of those who defied the odds and fought passionately for their beliefs. Whether they're right or wrong is up to you to decide. From Vercingetorix's doomed rebellion against Rome, to Osceola's unshakable war against the USA, all the way up to the inspiring Sobibor concentration camp uprising in World War II, each episode is an immersive listening experience, blending music and sound effects to really draw you into the story. Our episodes go for about 45 minutes, making them perfect for your commute, and are crafted using a wealth of historical sources, which I list on our website if you want to learn more. I'm the host, Elliot Gates, and I'm thrilled to have you joining me as we uncover history's hidden gems and illuminate the faded pages of our past. Look out for the Anthology of Heroes podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, or anywhere else you get your podcasts from.